It's 1965. A white minister is murdered in Selma, Alabama, but no one is held to account.
More than 50 years later, we return to the place where it happened, to call a lie, and finally solve this murder.
White Lies, from NPR. New episodes drop Tuesdays.
From NPR Music, it's All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. I'm here with NPR Music's Tom Heisinger. And today, a conversation with Radiohead's Johnny Greenwood, talking about his music, which premiered at the Tiny Desk today.
You probably know him as a guitarist for Radiohead, but Johnny Greenwood has also been composing music for films like There Will Be Blood and Phantom Thread, and for orchestra and chamber groups over the years. In fact, the music you're hearing is called 88 No. 1, one of the two world premieres of Greenwood pieces. We commissioned members of Ensemble Signal to perform them at the Tiny Desk.
We spoke to Johnny in his hometown of Oxford, England, at a small BBC studio there. Tom and I were here in Washington, D.C., I started the conversation by asking him what kind of music was playing around the house when he was a kid.
I'm a youngest child of the family, so luckily I've got older brother and sister with good taste in music. I just heard their music, really. It's funny to think about the other day, we only had about like 20 records, I think. Not through any sort of deprivation, just because that's just how we were. And so we ended up listening obsessively to the same recordings over and over again, which, looking back, I'm kind of glad I did, because it was about, you know, you'd really get deeply into things, even if they were, you know, on the surface quite frivolous. You'd really obsess about recordings. And yeah, so I remember every morning before school, Colin, my brother, also in Radiohead, would always play one of the same like three or four records every day, and a weird mixture of things as well, like, as well as things I'm proud of and always mentioning, like New Order or Smiths or whatever. There's also lots of Kid Creole and the Coconuts, and just odd mixtures of things, quite disparate, but also very limited in number.
You want to pick one?
Oh, I mean, like, I used to listen to Annie, I'm Not Your Daddy an awful lot, and just kind of marvel at how it sounded, as well as Everything's Gone Green by New Order. That was something we listened to like every morning for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. It was just part of the routine. It's funny.
Let's do that. That, there are many versions of that song, by the way. Was that the version you listened to?
I think so. The only thing missing is the same jump in the record. So there's one word of that lyric that I haven't actually heard, possibly ever. I was waiting for that skip to happen, and it didn't, which is very peculiar.
I love that. What was it that you were listening to it on? Was it describe it, and was it in your brother's room?
No, it was... it was the, you know, sitting room downstairs, family. family all in one hi-fi kind of thing. Yeah, and it would be like a 12-inch single.
I can imagine that's really good music to listen to in the morning to get you ready to go to school.
I mean, it puts me right back to kind of dark winter mornings in England and getting books ready and to head off to school. Yeah, it's weird.
We know a little bit now what you're listening to when you're getting ready to go to school in terms of like records, but I'm wondering back then in those days, what was the first instrument that you actually played?
Well, it was the recorder, and I'm sure I've already bored your asses off talking about recorders before. But yes, it would have been that.
You haven't bored me, so I want to know. We called them, because we had plastic ones when I went to school, we called them flutophone.
Flutophones, right.
Wow.
Yes.
I played one too.
Yeah, did you?
Yeah.
So what would like Hot Cross Buns was the number one tune back then.
Okay.
Yeah. What about for you?
Well, I mean, I took it very seriously and kept playing them until I still play it.
Wow.
So I was in recorder groups all the time and hanging out with those kind of dangerous teenagers who like to play recorder.
So
pretty dangerous.
When did the guitar show up in your repertoire then?
Late, really late. My brother played, Colin plays classical guitar, and I would occasionally take it from his room, but I didn't get a guitar till I was 15, something like that.
So just in terms of years, to give people framework, you're 15, yep, maybe in mid-80s, 80, 86 or
yeah,
so.
Yeah, exactly.
But listening to other music, like if you're playing the recorder, then you're not listening only to New Order or Magazine or someone like the British bands of the day. What other music were you listening to that either the recorder or that kind of music would have fit into?
I mean, I can name bands and stuff, but what's becoming more clear to me is how lucky I was to play in these kind of little local groups, playing recorders and violas and things. And it was the music around where I grew up was really good in terms of how the local, you know, schools just had a network of great teachers, and you know, and there'd be summer schools all based around music, and I'd play like in churches playing little sort of concerts of amateur groups, choirs playing Bach, and we'd be playing the string parts, and I was really lucky, and that stuff had a big effect on me, I think. You know, that sort of concept of live music and all these different instruments and ways of playing them. And yeah, that was something I really, you know, lived for.
Bach is a long way away, it seems to me, from Olivier Messiaen, who's a composer, and you've chosen some music by this very devout Catholic but very free-thinking, freewheeling French composer, Olivier Messiaen, and the Turangalila Symphony. It seems you must have been kind of a precocious grade schooler listening to the Turangalila Symphony at that age. How did you get turned on to that?
I think it was because a teacher played it to us when we were 16.
Ah.
And he pointed out that this composer was still alive, which he was in the early 90s. I found that really exciting, and I thought that was the same as being into bands. Something about someone still being alive and writing music meant that in my head that was the same as, you know, Magazine or New Order or whatever.
Wow.
Allowed me to get excited about it in a way that some of the nerdier kids around me possibly didn't. Not that I was free of any, you know, I mean, I'm a recorder player, so I'm as guilty of that title as anyone. But I just lumped them all together and thought that they're all as, you know, as wonderful and unattainable as each other, whether it's, you know, New Order or Messiaen.
I'm going to sneak some of this in here and let's hear a bit. Was this sort of a solitary listening experience, maybe, or did you gather with friends and listen to this sorts of music?
It was solitary. I mean, I think something about classical music that is quite a solitary experience, really. It's a good bedroom listen, really loud.
I'm curious if you ever had a chance to thank your teacher.
Good question. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Ian Donald, he was called. But yeah, I think he knows I really rated him, really enjoyed. And we had another music teacher called Simon Finlow. And this is when I was 11. He came into us at school one day and said, what makes music good? When is music good? Why is a song a good song? Mm. And everyone was giving their answers and saying, you know, well, if it's memorable and catchy, then it's good. I remember him unpicking that and trying to get to the bottom of what the point of music and songs and where the pleasure is. And I remember that being a really mind-blowing music lesson.
That is a great question.
So we have to ask it of you now. What do you think makes music good these days?
Oh, you'd think I'd have an answer after having 30 years to think about that. It's funny, I start to think that music is about surprising you, but in a satisfying way. I mean, there's some music that is just endlessly surprising, like from second to second, and that's usually quite exhausting to listen to. But some music surprises you, but in a way that's very satisfying, that it's still somehow right, but it's not necessarily, you know, predictable.
Messiaen was certainly one of those kinds of music.
Yeah, he's interesting because you hear like a few seconds of Messiaen and you know it's him. And there's not many composers you can say that about. He said he had a kind of musical language, had a color to his music that's unique, and it's special stuff.
Somehow I hear some of those colorings, or maybe at least the spirit of Messiaen, in one of the pieces that you wrote that was performed on the Tiny Desk by the ensemble Signal, which is three miniatures from water. And maybe it's just because you use the Indian drone instruments, the tempuras, in the piece. But were you thinking at all about Messiaen while you were writing that? Or?
Sure. I mean, it's something I keep going back to. He wrote music in certain set of scales. And that miniature that they did at the Tiny Desk is something written in the same mode. In fact, those brass you heard in that little orchestral part of Triangolina Symphony just now, that was exactly the same scale.
The octatonic scale?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Nice.
And it's just a nicer way to think of music, to have a set of limitations that, you know, notes that you're allowed to use, but outside of the world of, you know, major and minor. It's you know, it's an old idea, but it's really, there's something really satisfying about it.
I'd love to play some of that Tiny Desk. Obviously you can watch it online, but Tom, you want to introduce formally who's playing?
Well, we should mention too that the piece is called Three Miniatures from Water. We'll hear an excerpt now, and it's scored for piano, violin, cello, bass, and two Indian tampuras. And if you're not familiar with that instrument, it's a stringed instrument that provides the kind of a drone basis on a lot of Indian classical music. And the performance at the Tiny Desk is by the New York-based new music outfit called Ensemble Signal.
Great. And, of course, written by Johnny Greenwood.
Yeah. Just a little bit from Three Miniatures from Water, music written by Johnny Greenwood and performed by Ensemble Signal at our Tiny Desk performance that you can see online. Johnny, the drone situation in that piece is so great. I'm wondering, what is it about drones that is so comforting in a way?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so used to working with sounds that are very repetitious. And, you know, like holding down a key on a keyboard, or it tends to just, and there's so much music that is looped nowadays. There's something about drones that don't repeat and yet are the same note, but change in color and texture, that just are really fascinating. You know, it's really fun to sit and play a tempura and just listen to the overtones, and yeah, you can really get sucked into it. It's a lovely thing.
It's like you just being mesmerized by the waves washing in at the beach, or staring into a crackling fire or something. There's something just mesmerizing about it. But lovely, lovely music.
I also love the way that drones change everything around it, so that when other things, other instruments and sounds interact with the drones, it changes the nature of all the other music around it. So it's really
kind of beautiful. Exactly.
I wonder how you write music. You play many instruments. Like, do you hear it in your head and the actual writing of it is an execution, or is it all about the experimentation on, let's say, a keyboard or picking up instruments? What?
It's mostly done on paper, just because that's a clearer way to think. I just get so muddled with something about an untidy physical desktop is easier for me to deal with than an untidy computer desktop. And if I see all those little icons, and I'm just confused of,
huh.
I'm really cluttered, really untidy in any way. So working on paper is just feels clearer.
And so you're hearing it then in your head, and writing the notes down is simply just a way to notate what you want to be heard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I'll sit at the piano and work on paper like that, and then develop stuff.
And then, you know, do you use any like composing software like Sibelius or anything like that, or you just go old school straight to manuscript paper?
I quite like using Finale, which is the software of choice for nerdy music engravers. It's like someone once told me that musicians use Sibelius and computer programmers use Finale, which is cruel but probably true. So I quite like that. I quite like it. But then it's quite deceptive, because it's a bit like word processing, in that you can write something terrible in text, but if the font's nice, you start thinking, maybe this is a well-written novel I've got here. And it's a bit like that with music. You can make it look amazing and look like real music, and then when you hear it, it can, you know, can be a disaster. So yeah, and also using that kind of software does tend to lead you down certain routes, and you start writing things that sound good in the computer, which isn't the same as sounding good in real life, obviously.
When you heard Lisa Moore performing this piece, was it as you imagined, or her interpretation inspire you or make you think differently about what you'd written?
Yeah, I mean, the unspoken thing is that musicians are doing most of the heavy lifting, really. Like actors in a script, I suppose. You can write something, and then it can be, even if you write something in a script that's a little bit banal, with good actors, they can make it amazing. And I think the same is true with music. And so, yeah, it's a surprise to hear things being played differently, and almost always it's much better than you could have hoped.
Yeah, that's a cool analogy with the actors, because Olivia De Prato, the violinist in the performance of the music of yours that we just heard, she told me that she felt like you wrote the violin part with some room for interpretation and some freedom to lead the piece in different moods. And I'm wondering if that's kind of what you had in mind when you wrote it. You kind of leave some interpretive space in there.
Yeah, it's funny, because I like to hand things over and say all of this is just a suggestion, really. Just because I know that there's this unmeasurable, it's like an Indian music. There's so much you can't actually notate and write down and get onto paper. And there's also, at the same time, so much that all of these performers can do with their instruments. So many amazing things. There's a level of musicality that you have to factor in. You have to realize that it's crazy what these musicians can do, and just getting to write music for them is, it's a really happy motivation for me.
When did that start? When did that whole process of writing start? And what was that kind of stuff that you did write anyway? At what age?
I mean, I suppose it started with the Radiohead stuff, like even on the bends, there's a couple of songs with some strings in that would have just been, I think we had one cello and one violin, and that was really exciting. And then just over the course of how many records, we've just been able to get larger and larger. Not that that's necessarily a good thing, but just more regularly get more than two players in, and it's fantastic.
I'm going to play a bit of from OK Computer Climbing Up the Walls, just people hear your work now in this context from Radiohead.
And maybe like the end of it is really great.
Okay, I can do that.
Love those strings at the end of that, Johnny. They remind me of someone.
Yeah, I mean, I've been stealing from the same two composers since I was in my 20.
So, I wouldn't call it stealing, but...
Yeah, well, talking of school, we were always told that if you steal from one person, then it's theft, and if you take it from two, then it's inspiration, it's influence, you know.
Yeah. I don't know how true that is.
Or the other phrase is, if you're going to steal from the best, and that string sound there reminds me an awful lot of a composer that we know that you're a fan of, and that's Krzysztof Penderecki, right?
Yes.
And how did you get turned on to his music?
Okay, so just before we signed to EMI, I was lucky enough to do 6 weeks at college studying music. And in those 6 weeks, the first thing they played us was Penderecki. I think it was Polymorphia. And that was really exciting for me because I just saw him doing these very peculiar sounds. But it was all notated. It was all on paper. And yet an orchestra turned it into this strange, otherworldly, you know, collection of textures. And and I loved it. And then when I saw it live, I really loved it. I really just became 100 times better than the recordings. And yeah, I've been obsessed ever since.
Oh, yeah. You just can't get those sounds from electronics. That's a little bit of Krzysztof Penderecki's Polymorphia.
What are they, just banging their bows on the violins and more?
Well, Johnny, tell us what they're doing there.
And how do you notate that?
With lots of asterisks and explanatory notes, which exhaust and annoy most orchestras, I'm sure. It's one of those things that when you see it in a concert hall, it's very quiet and strange and very colourful, and it's not what you see when you listen to those recordings of Penderecki. You just associate it with horror films, and you think it's loud and abrasive and, you know, grating. But in the room, it's actually really just very colourful and quiet and peculiar, and it's a very magical experience. So, yeah, I recommend it.
And what they're doing there, if I'm not mistaken, is they're banging the wooden side of their bow on the strings instead of the horsehair side of their bow to get that effect, no?
They're probably tapping the instrument, like tapping the body of the instrument. He also does a thing where he has the bass players rubbing the wood and so that it squeaks. That goes on, and also you can bow the bridge, the wooden thing holding the strings up. If you bow that parallel to the strings, then you get a very high squeak, which again, if your ear is up close to it, sounds horrible. But when a room of 40 string players are playing it, it just sounds, you know, really wonderful.
You said that you went to school for about 6 weeks and you heard this music, and at the same time you were signed to EMI. Was there a tear? Because this sounds like you could have been too, in many ways, gone two completely different directions. And Was it the education and learning about all this music seems like such an attraction in many ways, and yet you went in another way. Was it hard to drop out?
No, my tutor told me to go. He said, what are you waiting for? Go. He was a really interesting guy called Charlie Blake, who he was friends with Iggy Pop, I think, and introduced us to Can as well. He was really instrumental in early Radiohead. He was the first person to give us a cassette with Can on. So he was a really... Yeah, influential man. And he said, go. The student's welfare officer told me to stay and said, don't forget it. So I had someone who was sort of 19 saying, stay at college, you'll be fine. My tutor was saying, what are you waiting for? Go and be in a band. Sounds great.
God bless teachers.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with Johnny Greenwood, and you're listening to All Songs Considered.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Blue, creators of the Yeti microphone. Ready to record that song, start a podcast, or launch your YouTube channel? Blue is here to help you tell your story and build your audience. Visit bluedesigns.com/NPR for special pricing. Raise your voice with Blue. Support also comes from Tito's Handmade Vodka. Born and bred in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Music's just kind of part of our DNA, says Tito Beverage, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka. For recipes, videos, and more, visit them at titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Incorporated, distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas, crafted to be savored responsibly.
I'm Tom Heisinga, along with Bob Boylan, and we're talking with Radiohead's Johnny Greenwood about his new compositions, 88 Number 1 and 3 Miniatures for Water, which were performed at the Tiny Desk, and about Johnny's admiration for composers like Krzysztof Penderecki. You say you're stealing from Penderecki and others, but that's not really true. You're influenced by them. But what do you really learn? What sticks inside your head from those composers all of these years? Is it just the sound world that they can conjure up with acoustic instruments?
I suppose with Penderecki, it's the complexity of it, which I really love. It's the fact that you have 48 individuals, and how they play is dependent on how they learn and what kind of day they had and how they choose to play what's in front of them. You know, that's complicated when you have two or three people playing together, and to have that many people, and then you've got the room and the shape of the room and how that sounds, and all those variables are really exciting to me. Partly, I think, because I'm just used to working on lots of music that is always the same, that is, you know, sequenced and dependably repetitive. Whereas with stuff like Penderecki, you can have an orchestra practice the same bar 10 times and every time it will sound different. And that level of chaos is really appealing to me. I think it's really interesting and far more interesting than lots of other ways of making music.
Let's hear just a little bit of, Johnny, of your music now that is kind of in the spirit of Penderecki from a film that a lot of us will know, There Will Be Blood. You've written a lot of scores for Paul Thomas Anderson's movies, and this is a really terrific score, and this section is called Henry Plainview. That's a little bit of Johnny Greenwood's music from the film There Will Be Blood. And how do you get that particular sound? That's all string sounds, right?
Yeah, that's just all violins. And they're playing quarter tones.
Ah.
And it's all clusters and standing. And then so-called normal chord emerges out of it.
So here's a question for you, because, you know, we know that you write software and you're kind of known as a person, well, let's just say it, a gearhead. And I'm curious, like, how does the tweaking of knobs on electronic gear compare to tweaking acoustic instruments to get those sounds for you when you're composing?
Oh, that's interesting.
Is it the same thing or is it different?
Well, you mentioned tweaking knobs, and that makes me think of modular gear, modular synthesizers. And the connection to Penderecki, which is interesting, is that he learnt about that method of making music in the 60s. So he learned about white noise generators and filters, and but then decided that he could go and do the same sounds with a string orchestra. So he turned his back on making that kind of music and went off and wrote things like Polymorphia, like you just played. And I think about that a lot, and think about that sort of that way of, you know, embracing the chaos of orchestral music as being really, really forward thinking and really, and I think he was right as well, because that a lot of that music from the 60s sounds like it's from the 60s. But then I meet people who tell me that Penderecki sounds really dated to them. So, you know, but to me, I think it still sounds like the music of the future, really.
I work with modular synths and stuff since the 70s and 80s, and always found the surprise that happens in those instruments are what spark me to move in directions that I wouldn't normally move in. And that's sort of what I love about them. You plug something into something else, and what comes out is not what you might predict.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's the complexity of what you have in front of you. And what we have with Radiohead all the time is we'll set something up and start recording it, and I will change one part or one level and then change another one, and then you can't go back. It's that moment's gone. You never get it sounding quite as good again.
Right.
And that's a really exciting thing as well.
Or frustrating.
Or frustrating.
but it
shows you that there's something that you can't kind of quantify, you can't really measure, you can't, you know, reliably reproduce, which again is something that I find really exciting.
Are there composers today that inspire you who are working in either electronics or with traditional instruments that you love hearing? Can we play some of that?
Sure. I mean, I love Steve Reich for sure. He's someone whose scores I spend a lot of time looking at and listening to, but he's a big influence for sure.
And it's the attraction to his music underlying oftentimes is a pulse and a drone. That must be an attraction, but there's more.
Yeah, I think if you listen to something like his Music for 18 Musicians, what's remarkable about that is it sounds exactly like this digital manipulation you can do on recordings today, where you stretch the sound, and it's called granular synthesis. So you can make sound longer in time without changing its pitch. And it's a really lovely effect. And then if you listen to Music for 18, it sounds exactly the same, except it was written, you know, 30 years earlier, and it's just done with acoustic instruments, and it's just the most wonderful sound, wonderful textures he makes.
I'm going to play something from Music from 18 Musicians here. Watching, maybe is the wrong word, but being present in a live setting to hear this music is—it's
amazing. Yeah. It really is, because it's like you're watching a whole animal with lots of limbs working, and the guys and the people playing the marimbas. It's so exhausting. You can only do it for a couple of minutes, and you have someone waiting next to them with a spare set of sticks to take over. And then they pick up the music they were playing, and they go to another instrument to play that. And it's people carrying pieces of music around the stage and just working. It looks like a crazy office is going on in a way, except they're all playing instruments. And it's all about the muscles of the players. It's such a physical thing. It's such a, you see the effort of the skeletons going into making this music. It's amazing. It's a really, and again, it's about, like you say, going to see it, going to the room and experiencing it live. It's really, it's like nothing else.
I know it's like Philip Glass, when he was starting out in the early 70s, he had just a few musicians with him, and they played primarily keyboards and a couple of winds. And he told us that, you know, when we were starting out, we had to actually learn how to play it. We had to start getting this muscle memory going in our fingers and to keep up with the design of the music.
Yeah. And I also love the story of Steve Reich just writing these phasing pieces and having them for tape, because obviously you can't get a musician to play ever so slightly slower than the person next to them. And then he meets percussionists who can do that. And suddenly this explosion of realizing that there are musicians who can do this crazy thing. You even see people do piano phase solo. So they have two pianos and both hands are playing the same thing, but the left hand is playing slightly slower than the right hand. And it's, you know, it's just bizarre.
I can't rub my head and pat my tummy. Yeah. I don't know.
How do they do that? Yeah. Well, actually, there's some things a little bit like that going on in the piano piece that you wrote called 88 Number 1 that's also performed by Lisa Moore, member of Ensemble Signal, part of this Johnny Greenwood Tiny Desk that we have up and available for watching right now. Tell us a little bit about what the piano is doing in the opening movement of this two-movement piece.
You want to hear just a second of this? Just a, sure. 10 seconds before he answers that? Here we go. And you hear her singing, too, or humming.
That's right.
That's intentional.
It is, yeah.
You want to tell us more about the intent? And
sure. I mean, so 88 has two parts. It's got the slow beginning, which is all based on my obsession with Glenn Gould.
Oh, hence the humming.
Yes, and the gloves. She has to wear gloves halfway through, and, you know.
Because when Glenn Gould recorded Bach, you could hear him explain.
Well, I think the gloves, I think, probably are twofold. One, that Glenn used to wear gloves sometimes, but number two, I think you have something in the score that for the way that the pianist has to cover the keyboard.
Yes,
yeah. It's good to have gloves on because it gets pretty wild in the second part, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But the humming.
So the humming, like Tom says, you hear him singing along, and that's something I've always been fascinated by. It's like I remember going to a jazz course once, and they were explaining that what you're meant to do is sing while you're playing and try and shorten the distance between what your head is hearing and what your fingers do. So you sing into the saxophone while playing, and then play what you've sung instantly, and try and make that a very, you know, close connection. And I always found that really interesting. Yeah, and so, and the Glenn Gould recordings, all the Bach, you know, Goldberg variations, and the were just something that I listened to an awful lot. And there's also a great film called 32 Short Films about Glenn Gould that I had a big effect on me when I saw that.
How old were you when you saw that?
I think that's like early 90s.
So you're early, and he was in your 20s.
Yeah, and he was very obsessive and just a fascinating player.
And then you've got a little note at the top of the score that says that the player should think about playing it like Thelonious Monk copying Glenn Gould playing Bach. So what does that combination sound like in your head?
I mean, now you've said it out loud, it just sounds very pretentious. But
no, I think it's cool.
I suppose I wanted the slightly comic, there's a sort of darkly comic way that Thelonious Monk's playing, I think, which I really love. I just wanted a, you know, unhealthy mashup of the two things, I suppose. But then Glenn Gould at the same time is also extremely fluid in terms of how he plays and unrigid. You know, some people play Bach like it's an exercise, but he really, you know, pulls it around, especially in the later recordings when he's playing, tends to play things much more slowly. Just, it's wonderful stuff, really.
Shall we hear a little bit of the second movement of 88 number one, where things get they heat up a little bit, let's say.
Great.
Thank you.
Have you tried playing this?
Yeah, I can play. It's like I'm very good at bluffing. And so what I can do is comfortably play the first like 8 bars and then I'm lost. So I make up an excuse to leave the room at that point. It's a bit like, I do that a lot. I do it especially with languages. Like I've learned how to really thoughtlessly say things in Japanese, but they tend to be things like, you know, I've got to go now, or just say something. So it's quite convincing that you can, I can. I mean, that's how it's written, by playing the first few bars and then trying to work out how it can be developed and then handing it over to someone who's can do the ridiculous things you're asking them to do. And these players exist, and it's amazing, really.
And this is Lisa Moore. Tom, when she finished or played this or worked on this, did she say things to you
about she said that she found it pretty challenging herself, and she's, you know, known the world over as a champion of new and contemporary piano music. She said it was challenging because it was so exposed and clear and very linear, and then she also said that she felt like some of it was written almost as if it were more for a guitarist, with she noted these difficult chordal jumps in the left hand and things like that, which, you know, makes me wonder. I mean, I assume you wrote this on a keyboard, right, Johnny?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, do you think of difficulty factors when you're composing? Like, am I sure that someone can play this, or doesn't it really figure in that much?
I have a weirdly, it's a bit like inverted snobbery, in that I'm guilty of writing something and then thinking, this is a bit simple. And it's a bit childish. It's like it's too easy to play, therefore I worry that it's not worth doing, which is really stupid, backward logic, but I end up doing that quite a lot. So, yeah, like simple music makes me suspicious, which is completely wrong, and I'm trying to kind of grow out of it. So even like hearing the beginning of that 88, the slow movement, I'm sitting here thinking this is really slow and empty and there's not much happening, and, you know, it's that panic of, you know, anyway.
Right.
I'm sweating in this room, I've got to say. It's like I'm this tiny radio station in Oxford in a very small room with no air and no windows. And I'm loving talking to you guys, but I'm probably going to go a bit mad.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, keep going.
No, I was going to say, I feel like we did good and I'm happy we had this conversation. So I was going to wrap it just by saying, I love the contrast that happens in both. And for me, one is so much a part of the other, meaning the simplicity and the complexity together just make the things that I want in music to happen. They give me time to think and breathe, but also get excited. And these two parts of this piano piece did that for me, and it was really thrilled to be in the room while Lisa played this.
Thank you. Amazing. That's really sweet of you to say. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you for taking the time to write this and allowing us to put this out in the world.
Thanks for letting me on the Tiny Desk sessions. They're amazing. You guys should be so proud of them, really.
Thank you.
It's a really special thing.
We feel fortunate. We come to work and some amazing musician comes and plays for us, and we feed them and then they go home.
Fantastic.
If you ever love to come, if you're ever over.
Open invitation.
Yeah, totally.
Amazing. Would love to, really.
Sweet.
Johnny, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. Nice to talk to you finally. And you guys take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Be well.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye.
Johnny Greenwood's new work, performed by Ensemble Signal at the Tiny Desk, is online now.
Go check it out.
I'm Bob Boylan.
And I'm Tom Heisinger.
For NPR Music, it's All Songs Considered.